Conference record has joined the conference.
So here is Andy and Bob. Thank you. So I think that is this one actually on? I think this one is actually on. Okay, yeah. So now what we do is we're going to try to do this in try to finish as close to 2 o'clock as we can. The next stage of this is to talk about outcomes. Based on, and obviously we haven't, you know, consolidated all of this into one comprehensive vision statement or a set of key principles, but carrying with you the conversation from this morning, what we want to do is to think about what are all of the outcomes and ideally the measurable metrics that that we can identify that we would want to hold ourselves accountable to as the measurements of a successful system. They're going to happen on several levels, I think, and maybe we should just try to work through them individually. Yes?
Can I just make one point? It did come up this morning, and I just wanted to not come up before we leave, but the idea of whatever you we construct, recommend that there be choice, and that people get the kind of education, consumer education, enrollment brokers, I don't know where that fits in the day, but I wouldn't want that to go on.
Okay, so maybe, so Andy, why don't you, where?
Maybe that's parking lot.
Yeah, just put education, information, consumer choice.
Choice of plan, choice of health, okay. Choice of
yeah. And so I think that really belongs to our basic principles package. So if anybody wants to move a dot from somewhere else that you put it over to this choice concept, but we'll remember it as a latecomer. So now back again over to the outcomes. I think what we want to talk about is client-patient level outcomes, provider, service deliverers outcomes, and payment fiscal managers. Outcomes. Does that sound like the right outcome, Mike? Patient-level outcomes, provider-level outcomes, and payment system managers' outcomes. Okay. So let's start with the most important, the patient-level outcomes. What are the in a ideal system? What will be the best measurements of positive patient outcomes? Kathy? Reduced hospital readmissions? Reduced hospital readmissions. Okay. Sanjeev?
Medication
adherence. Okay. John?
I would say
Improved self-management.
Okay. That was from Harvey, not John. Thank you. Alan? Housing, independence, and work or education, activities, involvement in.
So housing, work,
being involved in life instead of being just a patient. And I also just think less usage of the system, period, whether it's a therapist or an ACT team or whoever it is. It's just a reduction in services, period.
A reduction in sort of crisis services, or I don't know.
Instead of somebody having to go to a program 5 days a week, and they want it because their life is changed, because their recovery has changed, now they're volunteering someplace 3 times a week, and they're only coming 2 times a week. That is
a less dependence on. Okay, so let's sort of help finish Ellen's goal statement here, because I think we have a sort of a long-term vision would be more independence, less dependence on the mental health care delivery system, because they don't need it, not because it's not available, but because they don't need it,
and their supports have become more natural in the community, and they're integrated and fully integrated into their community.
So, Kathy, do you
want to
amend
or ask that? For individuals right now that are not receiving services that they need, for them, the better measure, I think, might be accessing services.
Eventually not
using
them, but... Right. So that's increased screening and assessment?
So just one way to push it, to say that the population of people receiving care ought to be like the prevalence of the conditions that we know exist in that population. Yes, it is. But right now we're at, 5 or 6% in TANF for any specialty mental health services. And who is kidding who? I'm not sure if it ought to be the prevalence, but it ought to, more reasonably approach the prevalence. So this is an, but and I'm trying to frame this as an outcome of screening and engagement.
Will you say it again, Mike?
The population receiving care for these disorders ought to approximate the prevalence of the conditions that are being treated in the population under care.
If you have a need, you should get service.
Something.
Right. So we should know that you are in need, and there should be a service to meet your need.
Well, you're found, and then something happens.
It's even less in a way than outreach and service. If you think about what Mike's talking about, it's in our standard population Medicaid and people in health plans. And I'm not talking about seriously mentally ill folks, but just average ADA kind of members. People are not accessing, and that's true in the commercial population as well, actually. People are not getting services at the level that our epidemiological knowledge would suggest. And so, as a concrete example of the issue, we just had another discussion last week about depression screening. We know a lot about depression. We know a lot about depression and comorbidities. You can go on and on. But we also know that people go to their primary care doc who could be screened in a very simple way are not getting picked up. The first example is very concrete and easier to find than some of these others, where we know there are people who are costing more money because depression has more comorbidity. They're also having human suffering, and we have a way to get to them, and yet we're not.
Reduce symptoms, improve functioning. Okay,
Paul?
I'm
just going to add on my Eileen's excellent point that the same thing obviously goes on to substance use disorders. Yeah. If we have that first, it's often not used. And then the other thing I would suggest is outcomes that relate not to health, but to other parts of life. Increased employment, reduced criminality.
I think the measure that Eileen, correct me if I'm wrong, was you were talking about service penetration, which is the extent to which in a group of individuals. So the other one, I guess, then would be service intensity, which is the tendency of people get in service, stay in service, and get the proper level of service. So I don't know whether that's a patient-related outcome or a plan or provider.
Related outcome, but I think it impacts patients anyway. Cindy. Maybe back to me on Laura, but really having individuals actively engaged.
I thought engagement was very important, and I almost thought, but we're talking about two things. Like for some clients who are not engaged, being in service, being in treatment is actually a positive outcome, as distinct from the recovery trajectory, which would have you use fewer services, et cetera.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
essentially two different things. One is that you have
We all know that the empirical data shows that there's a, as the commissioner said, a proportion of people are not accessing services. So what you want to do is to be able to increase the number of people in these services that are being identified and being referred to services, to appropriate level of services. And the other thing is, as you know, and when we talked about the revolving door of people going into the shelter system, into jails, for treatment, and you have people that are accessing all of these systems, what you want to do is to get them the appropriate level of care, right, and thereby reducing the issue that they're moving through all of these systems and not really getting the adequate services that they require.
Thank you.
For me, an important issue for families that are involved in the child welfare system is that there is an opportunity for children to return home to their biological families to cause the issues that, in fact, led to the removal are remediated or under better control so that those kids are not languishing in the foster care side of the system, but, in fact, back home because of the support that the parents or parents have gotten. Yeah.
And can I add to that and to say in general that that individuals are served in the lowest level of care across all these, right? So for lowest, obviously, appropriate level of care. That so out of institutional care, out of government care, home-based settings, whatever and wherever appropriate.
Okay. If I may make a friendly amendment, I would say that people are placed in the appropriate level of care. Because there's some people that benefit from outpatient services rather than residential, but you're always going to have a percentage of the population that's going to require more intensive care.
This is another one that touches on and integrates several things that have been said, but a little bit less on you, what you said, a little bit full what you said, but I'm thinking about a measure and outcome that has something to do with, for those people who have significant/chronic/ whatever term you want to use, and I'm thinking about chronic in the medical illness context. We want to increase continuous engagement in appropriate treatment because we have a problem with discontinuity. So the one aspect of this is medication adherence, but another aspect is just dropping out and not. So we want it to be continuous, but we want it to be appropriate.
Sounds like the key indicator or, that we need in order to measure whether or not clients receive the benefits of this work coordinated care management, right? Some measure of continuity of service. Yes?
You also might want to include some hard measures with medical. So, for example, for diabetics, if they have a certain hemoglobin A1C, for hypertension, if that's normal, et cetera. If you need a hard benchmark from the medical side, that would be appropriate for patients on those kinds of illnesses.
Andy, do you have hard benchmarks on medical.
Throughout all of this, I really want to see us be very cognizant about the fact that in every outcome there has to be participant involvement, choice, and direction, so that we're not just putting this on people, that we're encouraging people's participation. So actually we try to be a more provider, and a participant outcome would be increased choice, increased voice in the plan, in the direction that they're going, the treatment.
Something Ann said stimulated me, I'm thinking as we've been talking.
we talk about outcomes, and in the world I live in, when we look at outcomes, we have very clear measures like the hemoglobin A1C or any number of others. As we move to a system where we have more metrics and measurements to know if we're doing a decent job and really transforming it, the challenge is going to be to come up with real evidence-based measures. Otherwise, it's all in the eyes of the beholder. And we need to figure out a way to know what's the evidence out there, what are the measures. Otherwise, you can't operationalize. So that's, it's not another thing to add, but it's just something to mention to ourselves to highlight. It's a fundamental principle about data-based decision-making, evidence-based, healthcare, et cetera.
Let me mention one thing, most of it we heard about last week. Now, this stretches the framework a little bit, but the Henry Ford Health System was set out to deliver perfect care for depression. So this is, Six Sigma level of care for depression. As they thought about goals, the goal they ended up with is to reduce suicide among the population under care with a goal of eliminating it completely. And they've done it now for, 10 quarters in a row for a substantial population under care. So not having people die would be a good one. Suicide.
You talked about, for some people, the importance of taking medicine. For other people, given the harmful effects of our medications, it's about getting people on either off or on less medicines, less strong and less long. Also, let's also put on the table that if we're good at engaging people, then there should be a decrease in use of force treatment. Particularly here in New York, on Kemper's law, would be a nice measure if a few years from now we've done such a good job engaging people that the orders drop dramatically.
So this is sort of related. It goes back to what Alan said, and I wonder about. I'm not sure that I've seen this before, but a goal of to increase the proportion. You couldn't keep increasing it forever, but we have a long way to go before we risk that. To increase the proportion of health goals that are met through self-management. That's a client level.
To increase
the proportion of client health goals that are met through a self-management approach.
As RBC was speaking, it also popped into my mind that we would want people to have decreased violence in their life, right? So, and it's not just about whether or not they're the perpetrators of some violent act and come in contact with the criminal justice system, but whether they're the victims of violence, whether they're engaged in domestic violence, and sort of the reduction of their.
I guess we have to decrease the violence.
That was an early onset, yes. Okay, any more?
Your comment about violence is not just criminal justice. You're talking about trauma in general, right?
Yes.
So there should be probably some trauma-related recommendation that I'm not smart enough to think of right now.
Well, I don't know if we're ready for this. This is more input than outcome. But, the standard of care is going to be to always assess trauma. No, we're not quite there yet. So to increase the level of which trauma is routinely assessed.
Well, that falls into several categories. You could also make the same argument that there are a lot of people suffering from trauma that are not being identified and not accessing services. They're not being retained in services. And you're right, you need some outcome measure because the definition is broader. It's just, we deal with it from a veteran's issue. We combat veterans, so we're more focused on trauma from combat. But then you have domestic violence, and you have all kinds of other, there's a more expanded definition of trauma that should be addressed because it really has major implications for the delivery of services.
This is, and maybe this it all wraps up, but early on, I mentioned, I think, Laurie, with you about how the premature death in general, that individuals will die. So maybe what we need to do is to close the inequality gap in the longevity. Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yep. That is very good.
That, you know, suggested that a Surgeon General, somebody ought to define that as a health disparity, and I can't remember who brought it up before, but whoever did sort of framed it that way. So we want to reduce health disparities that are associated with having a behavioral health problem, including, you know, premature death.
We're going to move on to the provider after Kathy's last comment.
Just one?
Absolutely. The last.
Just as a follow-up on Mike's about consumer-driven, the role of prevention, so that as we think about in a primary care setting, so for instance, high-risk mental health, substance disorders, high-risk for hepatitis A, B, C, and sort of make sure people are appropriately screened and also appropriately screened for depression and substance use disorders across all healthcare settings so that we get more people access to treatment.
Okay. So now let's think about our service delivery system and the providers who are going to be out there acting in this well-informed, transparent at the client level for the providers, coordinated way with care coordinators helping to sort of orchestrate best system and, you know, consumer-driven choices. What are the provider level, what are the outcomes that that we want them to be, to guide their practice by and for them to be accountable to? Okay.
So a couple of, you know, the use of tools like wellness recovery action plans that really get what people say they want and need, and the memorialization of that in advanced directives, and getting ahead of the electronic records. That advanced directives be prominently displayed in electronic records so that they're really seen.
And he does that?
Sorry,
enhance
the
use
of
And there are also ways, and there are some tools to measure integration of substance use and mental health services, for example, and thinking about, meaning, you know, assessing providers in that area. I don't know if they're completely valid tools, but there are tools that are being developed along those lines to sort of measure the integration issues around substance use, particularly mental health. And I know some folks are also working on measurements of, like, are we really integrating health and behavioral health? So that's a metric. And there's some process metrics, obviously, in terms of access to providers, like, you know, when if someone's in a hospital, are we seeing that person? Are we following through? Is there continuity? Are we losing people? You know, but again, I guess my point is that there are some other ways of measuring integration, but also most of those things, like I could probably say, at an aggregate level, we should be providing.
I think that's almost like, so, and I guess you always want to have some kind of a way to gauge whether or not your population is significantly different than others, but you want essentially providers to be held accountable for, what, you know, equal levels of excellence in terms of each of these client level outcomes, right, as it relates to their entire population. What about this this issue of, you know, sort of, you know, cowboys going in alone, who, you know, sell that, you know, care coordination, stuff, all that, you know. So what are the ways that systems can measure whether or not providers are with the program in terms of really working in a coordinated fashion across these disciplines? Is that a key outcome for providers?
What?
Do you have to really be able to see the data, in a sense? I mean, this is not from a subjective impression, right? So here again, I think you need some measurement that reflects data that you get through the system. So if everyone's writing on the same virtual medical record, it becomes clear to one of the providers maybe that someone is screwing up here. Right?
Yes.
So that would be, it wouldn't be a goal in itself, but it certainly would be some kind of a mandatory participation in a sharing of time.
Well, yeah, I mean, you also want a record of the patient can get access to.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
Yeah.
I mean, I think one way to look at what you're referring to, this notion of effectiveness of care coordination, is at the provider level is the ER utilization, for example, of individuals. If indeed it's working, then that should change over time.
Maybe some retention data. You know, I think that's more concrete outcome. If a consumer comes to me to clinch the services, and I, and after, let's say they're a high user and care coordination makes that referral, and I, that person is not fully engaged, there are ways we can look at retention data. If I'm a provider, am I losing people in the early stages? And there's also evidence that the more that we can engage someone in the early stages, But I think it's a good piece of data to look at and understand what it means.
Okay, maybe it's just a couple more on the hand.
You can monitor the connections to care, transitions, so for example, appointments to primary care doctors after hospitalization, appointments to clinics after hospitalization. These are classic measures that people use, but I think they're important to continue to use in the care coordination, that you know at least if the patient got where they were supposed to get, and that's really important. Your responsibility. And also, I think to refine the patient thinking, the communication that has to happen at different levels, whether it's electronic or even certain pieces of key information have to be transmitted from one provider to the next, and they should help account for doing that. I think you have to spell that out more, but I think that's very important.
Okay.
Sorry,
Dan,
yeah,
get
a
minute.
To think about the communication responsibilities between and among providers, and not just the healthcare
providers.
You can't
have continuity if you're not doing your case notes and making them.
Exactly. And, even housing, everything. If you really have a cold communication system that works.
CMS has a 20QA for the dual population, the structure and process measure. There's something called SMC4, care transition.
Yeah.
And it's a way to make, in this case, plans accountable for the efficacy of care transitions, but it speaks to the same idea, but it has clear-cut goals and objectives and standards that people can adopt and score upon.
A couple things. One of them is the evidence of effective cultural competence and penetration into and workforce.
What's the social competence and?
Cultural competence and penetration, with engagement of historically underengaged groups, diverse groups. Also, one evidence of that would be the workforce of the, you're hiring people who look like and talk like the people you're serving. Another one would be, are you serving people in the most integrated setting? Are you keeping them in programs most of their lives? And are you also using peer services?
Yeah,
one of the things is we talk about engagement a lot, but I would want to see from providers the different ways in which people are engaged. Can it only be within the doors or the confines of that office or that place where you deliver services, or can it be, on the street by the train station or, at a break during the person's work, down at the person's house, and the type of relationship or the depth of the relationship and how that's, it's easily noted that when people spend time with people on the front end, it's like Donna just said too, it kind of cements them into
early
engagement. And that the person you're serving is engaged in that relationship. That they're not just being engaged, but they're willingly engaged in it as well.
Let's move on to payment. I have to see if I know how to ask the question. What are
for our reimbursement system, what would be the metric that the department, that the budget office, that consumer advocacy groups would want to see as healthy indicators of a well-functioning payment structure? Done.
As healthy as indicators of a healthy payment structure.
Payment structure.
So I would say that we most definitely would be incentivizing outcomes. I think coming from this group specifically, if you could demonstrate a decrease in unnecessary hospitalizations, if you could demonstrate a decrease in the use of more expensive care where it's clinically indicated that a less expensive level of care is more appropriate, and if there was, I think, some demonstration, and again, this requires both regulatory relief and flexibility, if there's some ability for service providers and consumers to be working together, a little variation on the theme of that pool of dollars, the expectation is we're going to be managing our resources better. The consumer should be feeling much more empowered and much more taken care of. The provider should be feeling they're being completely compensated for the cost of delivering the service, and then the ultimate outcome being that we're driving down costs elsewhere.
Yeah. The method of payment should support the proper level of care so that it shouldn't, people should not be maintained at a higher level of care for overly long. I don't know what that is.
I thought your question was a little more macro. Maybe we can look at it on a couple of levels. But on a very macro basis, from the city or state perspective, from a budgetary perspective, it seems to me that if some of the reforms and transformations we're talking about were to happen, the outcome should be that there's two sides of this. There's reducing the cost, the flexibility, early and sort of all the things we've talked about. We want to reduce the high need, you know, the high cost, sure. At the same time, we want to serve those people we just talked about who are not in the room. So I don't want to say we should just save money because that doesn't deal with both sides. So it seems to me there still should be, I believe, some reduction altogether, an absolute reduction of dollars. But the more important measure would be what we spend on, we spend less money on the high-end individuals so that we would be serving more individuals. So we save money, serve more individuals at a more appropriate level of care.
Then I would think that issues like prompt contracting and prompt payment are critical, and you know perhaps whoever's managing the dollars could be incentivized or disincentivized based on their. I know. Rather.
I strongly endorse what Eileen said, and then also I think this is a really important place for ensuring that the principles of parity are being followed and that people are receiving what care they need without artificial or extra deductibles, co-payments, limitations on the services that they need.
Most of the money goes to care in the system. That sidetracks the place on.
So the other side that you very artfully didn't say is that there shouldn't be excessive skimming of the dollars out of the system for management and you know, equity pay and all this stuff.
It's just lays bureaucracy.
Kelly. Usually it's Kristen, which was my older sister, but that's okay. I'm trying to think of the kind of the bells and whistles and incentivizing you can do with Medicaid, because, you know, Medicaid rates legally have to be adequate to be able to provide service, right? So if you have this base piece that says Medicaid rates are adequate, you know, are you looking more for the kinds of things we're talking about before, you know, other than pay for performance, you know, bundle the rate all together, incentivize quality, but I guess are you looking for things that might be even more out of the box that way? So that's what we're talking about.
Ooh, that's good.
I guess I think I'm looking for more flexibility than there has been, is at least coming to my mind right now, so knowing that at least you have to have access rates.
So
I don't know if there's anything very intelligent right there, but...
A flexible rate structure that allows for... adequate rates with flexibility within to do what you
right,
want.
Right, which I suppose is many new ideas. I'm just trying to see, you know,
yeah,
maybe
so
you have to have an adequate rate
right.
And then go from there.
Okay.
Yeah. I just want to reinforce that point that something relates to the cost of care, not just outcomes, performance outcomes, that there has to be something that supports actually the provision of care, not just the outcome. The issue of adequacy is a very real issue because there are costs to maintain services that go beyond whether the successful outcome is produced that will, if not attended to, will actually reduce capacity and availability. So I think that's a balance.
So it's a great system that has a balance of adequate facility without subtracting from adequate incentives.
Correct.
I think we'll hear some of this when Eileen and Richard sort of take us through a little bit of the state of the art, which I think is going to, you know, take them a little bit to prepare. So maybe not at this meeting, but we know some things that are specific to the behavioral health arena in this regard. Like, for example, that we know from the Rand Health experiments a long time ago that if you make psychotherapy too cheap, people will use too much of it, as opposed to primary care. So it's mental health care, at least with respect to psychotherapy, is much more price responsive, which means you can't pay too much for it, you get too much of it. But, and if you pay too little for it, this is the other consequence, it goes away entirely. So we've seen that in... That's one of the characteristics at the plan level. You've got to, and several principles that have come up here go this. You've got to pay enough for care. You've got to make sure the networks are adequate, which is a different, you know, sort of issue. And if you, you know, we learned this in some of the early approaches. If you just capitate behavioral health care, you decapitate it because all the money goes out, you know, because you can suppress levels of care much more easily than you can, you know, anyway.
I want to reiterate as an outcome one of our earlier principles, which is that there is a financial structure in place that a provider or a payment manager has no incentive to inappropriately draw funding out of one element of the system and place it toward another, so that the incentive is structured in a way that all the physical health, the mental health, and the substance abuse needs are given their full due without any incentive to move away from those systems.
Can I just add something to that? In the same vein, we don't want a system that encourages screaming. So in other words, if you're paying,
so there's everything that
you need. Right, because
yeah.
You want, I mean, it's like you need like a risk adjustment to look at outcomes because the outcomes are different for different groups. You don't want providers to be the, for whatever reason, to pick the easier case. You want to have a system that supports the need.
Okay. And then let's, why don't we take some 5 after, and then we're going to have 10 minutes only to vote. Okay. So, Anne, I saw you first.
I'm not sure if this makes sense, but some way to kind of combine incentives between with housing in some way. So, for example, from the hospital perspective, often we feel that we could discharge patients into housing if there were more services around some of the housing options, and maybe some way to combine as incentives so that they might housing might be able to take some of the more fragile transitional clients into housing quicker if certain things were wrapped around them as well. So some kind of know, partnership between, I'm just thinking if there's some way to do that, since housing is such a critical issue.
So let me just mention something there that I think we're going to get into, although it's not uncomplicated. That, you know, one issue just is that housing is unaffordable. I mean, you know, you south of Poughkeepsie, you can't rent an apartment anywhere in New York State for the total amount that you get in your SSI check. So that's really the underlying problem. Then there's a question of staffing. And so one of the problems in the way we do housing in relation to Medicaid now is that it's site-focused. So it's only in licensed settings. And if we could keep that same resource but manage a little bit more flexibly across settings while making sure that it remains adequate, you know, in the unit, it would help with that problem. And theoretically, we could do that in the environment that we're going toward. It's not uncomplicated. There aren't other risks, but it's possible.
So I know that that the Pennsylvania plan actually managed the medical loss ratio. I'd like to see us manage the state-directed medical loss ratio, and it mandated some reinvestment of savings, because we all know that, you know, for example, takedown and discharge housing and diversion, possible diversion housing, is going to require, based on the bit that we have now, some enrichment. In other words, in order to achieve the goals we need, we're going to need to somehow find a way to put some money back in. So those two things.
One last comment?
Thank you. Agenda. Just as we get organized, I'll tell you what is going to happen with everything that's on the wall.
We are going to take these sheets down. A team of city and state folks are going to work together. Gail, I hear your voice.
I'm sorry.
We're going to work together. We're going to try to take all of this and put it into a very clear, coherent, and compelling vision statement with a set of key principles, and then an accompanying set of outcomes. We'll circulate that. Why don't I say, because I'm on vacation next week, they'll get it done next week and have it circulated to all of us by the following Monday. So why don't we give ourselves a week to get it drafted and out to you. And then let's maybe give ourselves a week from the time that it's sent out for you guys to give us feedback and amendments and then to finalize it. So Adam will assist them on our side. We'll figure it out. Adam, to relieve you of that, Barbara, wave your hand, Barbara. Barbara Kivett is in the back. Because she's the most skilled person now being in our office for all of 3 weeks, we'll coordinate the team on the city side and then work together with Bob on the state side, and we'll get a good team to pull these together for you. So, Steve? I think we should have a done product on our desk when we arrive on the 12th. Nice. Doesn't quite work, huh? All right, so I'll work on the time frames. We'll get something out to you with adequate time for folks to comment. Okay. So that will be our process for using all of this really great starting information. So, Arlene, our apologies to you for not having your PowerPoint up. Can we ask you to take us through that without the PowerPoint, and maybe just explain the next part of our agenda here? We have what will be 10-minute presentation. Yeah, we have 4 10-minute presentations. The thought is that not everybody in Harvey, not everybody in the room shares an equal level of expertise, and 10 minutes is woefully inadequate to make the room an expert on everything, but we thought a good, solid primer on best practice in a number of disciplines would behoove us as we sort of get ready for our next meetings when we're going to really dive into some hard work. So,
sure, thank you. Actually, Rob is going to do the presentation. I just want to indicate that while there's a lot of information here, I thought it was important that we define what the system looks like on the addiction side to make sure we're all on the same page. We look at the numbers. We tend to talk very anecdotally. So what this PowerPoint presentation is going to do is explain to us who we're talking about when it comes to the addiction field. So I'm going to pass it over to Rob.
All right, thank you. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Rob Kent. I'm a general counsel at OASIS. We thought, and I'll apologize at the beginning of the panel, I'll take the blame for it. It's on. Okay, I guess I got to really suffocate. But we thought, before we talk about what constitutes effective treatment and services that might be helpful, we just made the assumption that a lot of folks in the room know something about substance use disorder treatment in New York, but maybe not enough. And we thought, as you're going to be asked to make a bunch of recommendations to the MRT team and to the governor about what should go on with behavioral health after 2013, it'd be helpful for you to sort of have a more in-depth overview about what is the OASIS treatment system and what the impact is of Medicaid spending in it. So, and I'm going to rip through this because I know we got 10 minutes, and I'll hope my goal will be to be done in less than that. But so as a start, I mean, overall, that's at 261,000 individuals treated in our system in 2010. That's all. That's not just Medicaid. That's all treatment. You can sort of see the breakdown. I'll go into it a little bit in terms of the different types of services. Obviously, we just handed this out so you all could have it. You know, again, our one critical element in the OASIS system is a voluntary system. Even for those who are referred by criminal justice entities, they have consequences in the criminal justice system, not with our treatment system. If they don't comply with treatment, they'll be asked to leave. The consequences, obviously, they'll face are with the judge or the probation or parole, but we cannot legally keep them in treatment. So as you look at the treatment modalities, crisis services, of course, typical for New York. Crisis services is detox services. Why we call it that, I don't know, but medically managed is our highest level of detox. It's primarily hospital-based provision of detox care. Supervised withdrawal is a mix between hospital and community-based. Medically monitored are the crisis centers that are run throughout the state. There's about 18 of them. Inpatient rehab is 28-day model, is I guess how I would refer to it. There's a number of freestanding in the state. OASIS runs 12 state-operated addiction treatment centers. That's the modality that we provide in those settings. And there's residential rehab for youth, outpatient for youth, and there's various levels of residential services, not to be confused with inpatient rehab where you're living there for 28 days, but intensive residential, community residences, supportive living, are longer-term residential, I guess is how I would describe it for those who aren't familiar with the OASIS system. And then there's opioid or methadone treatment. I'm not going to go through this. You have it. There's a better, more fuller description of the different types of detox services. Of note, and I'll mention it again as we move forward, medically managed detox, medically supervised withdrawal and stabilization, our Medicaid billable services, the medically monitored crisis centers are not. They're all funded 100% state aid or net deficit funding. Inpatient rehab, which is the next thing, it's a Medicaid service. And there's a chart a few back that I'll spend a little bit more time talking to you in the lingo of what's carved in and what's carved out of Medicaid managed care. Because, of course, like a lot of things, it isn't as simple as certain services are in and out. It's some are in or out, and then people within those services are in or out based on their status. So we'll do that in a minute. And I'm not going to talk about the services for youth. I mean, you can read all of this. Chemical dependence outpatient is in Medicaid. And again, that there's a description of sort of what we're looking at for someone to be there. So I'll leave that to you to read. Opioid treatment.
Not knowledgeable at all, so I can ask this question.
Yes.
Are any of these services directly provided by state facilities, state run, or are these all provided?
Yeah, the only services that OASIS provides and is state operated is the inpatient rehab, the 28-day model. And we do that in 12 addiction treatment centers. Other than that, we have about 1,500 certified providers who provide all these different levels of services, hospital-based, community-based. Opioid treatment services, which are methadone, of note, and it's not on here, New York has the largest methadone system in the country, if not the world. We treat over 40,000 individuals in the methadone system. It's a Medicaid billable service. The residential services are not in the Medicaid system, intensive residential, community residence, supportive living. They're all long-term residential programs. Depending on who you talk to, they're also IMDs, so they're excluded from federal Medicaid, at least at this point. How much does New York spend annually on substance use disorder treatment? You see the number. That's all funds, includes Medicaid for 2011-2012. The next page, in the OASIS system, we have funded providers, non-funded providers. A couple are in the room. The major difference, for-profit providers, which do operate in our system largely in the outpatient world, cannot receive state funding, prohibited by statute. For those, we do fund not-for-profits, and we don't fund every not-for-profit, but we fund the net deficit. So we agree on a budget. We look at their third-party revenue, which includes insurance and Medicaid, and then we'll fund the deficit that remains. But as you look on that page, you go to the next page, you can see the different funding sources. We get, as a single state agency for substance abuse treatment, the $83 million from the Federal Substance Abuse Prevention Treatment Block Grant. We get $115 million overall. The remainder of that money is spent on prevention services, but we spend $83 million of that on treatment in our system. And as you can see, and I probably should have bolded it and highlighted it, $883 million is expected. This is for this fiscal year, so it's calculated, projected, would be spent from the Medicaid system on substance use disorder treatment. Now we'll start to sort of try to explain to you what's carved in, what's carved out. All of our outpatient, this is the easy piece, the outpatient services, so all the outpatient, methadone, are carved out of mandatory Medicaid managed care. They're all paid on a fee-for-service basis. So as you're talking about the fee-for-service world, that's a large part of what you'd be talking about. Inpatient rehabilitation, the 28-day model. The hospital-based receives federal and state Medicaid money because they are not IMDs. The state-operated addiction treatment centers and the community-based freestanding do not receive federal money. They're considered IMDs. I hope everyone knows what an IMD is, but they're institutes for mental disease, which the feds won't provide federal Medicaid money for. Those are paid with state-only Medicaid funding. And I won't get into the RSY for the youth services. Crisis services, as I said before, the medically managed and medically supervised detox, which are the two highest levels, are part of the Medicaid system. So if you flip to the next page, here's a chart. This sort of tells you what's carved in and what's carved out. All outpatient, as I said, is carved out of Medicaid managed care, paid on a fee-for-service Medicaid basis. The detox, you'll see the first two, it says they're covered by mandatory Medicaid managed care. They are, except you see the two asterisks, which is, many of the claims, and you'll see some dollar amounts in a few pages to give you a better sense of how much it is. If you're homeless, they can't force you into mandatory Medicaid managed care. Your claims are going to be paid on a fee-for-service basis. So there's still a significant portion of inpatient hospital-based detox that is paid for on a fee-for-service basis, not through the Medicaid managed care plan.
Can I understand, is this as it is pre-state fiscal budget adoption? Or is this the world before reforms? Are these the rules that just got adopted?
No, these are the rules as they exist now. As we move, more of this is going to change to we're going to be working with DOH, part of the MRT reform
here,
are trying to...
So this doesn't describe the rules we have to follow moving forward. This describes the rules as they've applied historically.
Right.
Okay.
But what I would say on that is that DOH has to work with OMH and OASIS as it transitions these populations into the mandatory Medicaid managed care. So while the statute moves that way, there still is going to be, you know, still going to need to be work done.
That is our task.
Right, but.
Okay.
Right. I mean, ultimately, as this group is looking to manage all benefits, to sort of eliminate the issues.
I think it would be great if this chart could be updated to reflect the new rule.
Sure.
I mean, that's
what absolutely we can do that.
Yeah. Just, I mean, you're talking about these services. However, these same individuals are in managed care for physical.
For other things, right?
I mean, to be clear. These services, that's what I'm saying, these services for these individuals are carved out of Medicaid managed care. Their health care services are most likely carved in and part of a mandatory Medicaid managed care plan, talking about the SUD services only.
We have about 1 more minute.
Okay. Well, then, I'm going to, you've got everything. The one couple that I would like to highlight for you, that page right there, you can see how much money from this going to state fiscal year 2010, how much was spent on all services and then broken down by categories for payment. Two other things I'd like to identify. The next page over, if you look at that first bullet and you look down to the second sub-bullet, over $1.75 billion in Medicaid was spent for non-SUD services for recipients of SUD services in state fiscal year 2010. So,
what kind of dollars? Medicaid dollars?
Yeah, Medicaid. That's Medicaid spending. So you can see there were 159,000 unique Medicaid recipients.
Holy smokes.
Right?
What's that?
It's like, that's a lot of dough.
It is. But the point, as we're talking about integrated care, you can see how much money is spent for the physical health care for individuals who also have claims for substance use disorder services in the Medicaid system. A couple other points I'll leave you with as we move forward. One of the big points on health homes, and I know it's an issue for the deputy mayor from New York City, and we've been talking to Adam Crofati a lot, last page. As we move forward on health homes for the OASIS system, how we integrate the MACS, which is our case management care coordination system. It's not a Medicaid service as we speak. We're looking to make it one. Greg walked out of the room. Our largest number of individuals in that MACS program, which has worked very well, is in New York City, and we view health homes and part of the work of this group is as we move forward, assisting us in trying to scale it up around the state and become as rich as the OASIS, I mean, the OMH system is in terms of targeted case management. But as we move it forward, as we've talked about consumer involvement, one of the huge issues for us is our largest penetration with it is in New York City. As we transition the MAS program into health homes, we want to be careful not to undo existing relationships with treatment providers, with care managers, case coordinators. So it's a major consideration we would put in front of you. We'll come back at another point to talk more about state-of-the-art, but we just thought it would be wise for people to have a better sense.
Was a scary wall as to how much you don't know, right? So this is it really is just a snippet of sort of an overview and, give us a sense of what we need to learn and understand. 1.175, that's my takeaway from this document.
Yep. And Rob, that's all for all the Medicaid dollars are all for the state share. Okay, somebody tell me how to get out of here.
Just to be clear, Harvey just asked the question. My understanding, DOH is posting all the presentations today on the MRT website.
Oh,
it was included. Mr. Weisskopf's checking as we speak and says it's there.
So now we're going to move on to the mental illness, what we know about adult mental illness and food care.
So we're approaching this from the opposite point of view. Arlene and Rob are starting with the way things are. We're starting with the way things should be. So this is to try to synthesize. So what I'm going to go through is either science or the highest level synthesis of what is known. So the highest level synthesis of what's known. And it's not all science. A lot of what's known hasn't been proved yet, and a lot of what is almost known hasn't been studied yet. So it's trying to get to both of those two things. And I'm going to take like 12 minutes for adults and do 8 minutes for kids because they're smaller. So it'll be 20 minutes. So this is to kind of ground this in the overall population. This is just I put this actually together to describe for politicians the full range of mental illness. This blends together adults and kids a little bit, but sort of 50% of us will not experience a mental disorder in our lifetime. 50% will. For those of us who will, about a quarter of the population during any year will experience a disorder, and then another quarter of the population won't in any year, but will lifetime. And then going down to the bottom, we see a representation of the degree of impairment or severity. So in any given year, 10 to 15% of the population will have an illness with some limited impact on functioning. So you go to work, but you're not doing very well at work. Another 5% modest impairment. So you go to work and you're really not there at all, or you're not going to work. And then 3 to 5% severe impairment. You're on SSI and you're not working at all, in a sense. And I go here in part to illustrate that there are several different levels of care that we're talking about here, where we have to talk about integration. So one version of our charge to focus on the deep end of the pool, the 3 to 5% at the bottom. But if we're going to focus on integration, we also have to talk about access to care and primary care, where right now not that much is done. So I want to start there just a little bit. This is just another a piece of data, sort of one of my one-liners about all this is when it comes to mental health care, you can pay us now or you can pay somebody else later. And generally what we do is we pay somebody else later. So we pay in disability costs, we pay in suicide and lack of productivity related to that, presenteeism, absenteeism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But this data just shows the years of productive life that are lost by major categories of illness. And so what you see is, sort of brain disorders, surprise, surprise, are the major cause of disability in the Western world, with depression being the single greatest disability-causing illness in the Western world, the developed world. So I want to go to depression a little bit, and this is beginning to focus on the job that is not yet done in the general medical or the primary care arena, where it seems to me we have to raise the bar as well. And I'm just using depression in a sense as a tracer condition, focused particularly on postpartum depression, in a sense, the steep end of the sharp end of the spear. So, 10 to 15% of women develop depressive episodes during pregnancy, and about 50% thereafter. 22% of all women have some degree of depression in the first year postpartum. The rates are greater in the TANF population. The data I've seen with some studies is a study that sort of participated in Cincinnati, 36% of women in the first year, actually the first 6 months after childbirth, tested for depression, and another 12% in the whole year. They weren't depressed at the first screen, but they were almost 50% of the population. And then just to indicate the significance of this depression, this data is from a spin-off study that was done of the biggest sort of real-world study, the treatment of depression. This looks specifically at the kids of moms who are under treatment in this research study for clinical depression. The actual number was 86% of these kids had some
psychiatric disorder. 50% of that was resolved by doing nothing except giving adequate treatment to the mother. 50% of it. And then, you know, the data on how well we're doing in the mainstream is not so good. About a third received treatment. That those numbers are actually dated a little bit. They're up a little bit, but less than 25% received minimally adequate treatment. So this is the one slide for me that represents where I'd like for us to end up vis-a-vis recommendations for general medical care. And that is, as I said before, when we're doing the brainstorm, we try to reach everybody with mental illness and impairment. I'm not being so radical to suggest everybody with mental illness ought to get treatment. I'll just let that hang there for a little while. I'll just settle with people who have mental illness and impairment. And to put this in perspective, Kaiser reaches 10% of their relatively healthy population with some form of mental health care in any given quarter, which far exceeds what we do in New York State Medicaid, by the way. Just imagine that. And then we take TANF as a population to focus on in the general medical sector. What should be done there? This is sort of the emerging consensus on the minimally adequate care in what we might call primary care. So everybody gets screened for depression. And, you know, why not everything? Well, it probably should be broader than that, but depression is what's been recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. We then know, and the best plans are doing that right now, best providers are doing that right now, that some aren't. We also know that screening is not enough. You've got to be able to get a person to care, and really the only way to do that is to have a clinician on site. A referral will not accomplish it because people will not follow through on the referral, partly because of stigma. But if the screen is positive to say, I'm going to have so-and-so come join us for just a minute, talk a little bit about this, and then you talk about them with them afterwards, people will go, and then that care has got to be stepped and measured, and that's got to be embedded in the EMR. And then it's also pretty clear that, that there are specifically indicated forms of treatment now for depression. And, you know, good plans are incentivizing the use of evidence-based intervention. So that's it for the shallow end of the pool. Now I'm going to the deep end of the pool. So this is like, I can't draw very well. This is my picture of the life course of somebody with a serious mental illness. You start along, you have an initial psychotic break. It gets very bad, you get hospitalized. You look good within 2 weeks, 90% of the time. So you regain functioning, very dramatic symptom relief. You then get sent out, you get no follow-up care, or you maybe get one appointment, you don't follow through, nobody explains what you have to do to live your life differently. You get hospitalized again. And every time you get hospitalized, you end up a little worse than you started out. And then, you know, the way this works for most people, it's Groundhog Day, and you go through the cycle again and again and again and again. So at some point you're about 50 years old, you start to figure it out yourself. And once you start to figure it out yourself, as my sister said to me, I don't have to like the medicine, I just have to take the medicine, then things get a lot better. But we sort of beat people down significantly before we get there. So there are sort of two general sets of recommendations that emerge from this. One is, and we've talked about this one a lot, that our interventions for people with well-established disorders should be with a recovery paradigm. But the second thing that we have the opportunity to do now is to sort of do a better job of ramping up and provide early intervention for people with psychotic illnesses by catching them before they go through that 30 years of lost life, because the models are starting to emerge for that. So a quick tour through this. This is an integration of the science with what is sort of consensus about the best way to do this, that care for people with serious mental illness is team-based. There's not much solo work that is done here. It's got to be continuous and it's got to be tighter, meaning that you stay engaged in care all the time, but it gets adjusted based on how you're doing, what you're learning how to do for yourself, and so on. It's got to be integrated. There should be a single master care plan that is your personal care plan, embedded in integrated HIT with care management delivered somehow. There can be different ways to get it done. Almost always, but not all the time, medication treatment is core to symptom management. That's a very personal journey because there are a set of pathways here, but we don't understand still yet which antipsychotic is going to work for somebody. And for some people with psychotic conditions, it's not going to be one. This is a sort of an expert adjustment of what works for me that is really integral. So usually medication management is critical, but always psychosocial support is critical, and that psychosocial support for people with the serious conditions is moving in the direction of wellness management. That is, it is a, we don't like the term, but it's a chronic illness model. It's focused on how do you live with this condition, how do you adjust your life, what do you have to do to be able to live a good life with the condition. The substance abuse treatment, if needed, has got to be integrated into the mental health treatment. If it's not, it won't work. The evidence is in on that. And it's also pretty common sense that these other things down at the bottom have got to be available if they're needed. They're not needed by everybody. But if they are needed, trying to recover when you're homeless is not, that's not going to work either. We've done a very poor job on these two middle things, helping people understand what their benefits are and how to maximize their benefits but not be trapped in them. We've just started to do that. It turns out to be pretty powerful. And the unemployment rate of people receiving care in our system is 85%. And the data is unequivocally clear that if you get a job, you use less medical care. But we don't help much with that. This is a really significant area going forward of to what extent can we integrate that. The way we have things now, care is discontinuous. It's not integrated. Most people don't get the other supportive stuff. Medical care is casual. And our past paradigm has been symptom management, not recovery. But as I put it here, this is changing very significantly in New York State, where we're really starting to upgrade and move toward a wellness management, life coaching kind of approach. Talked about health homes. This is a symptom of discontinuous care from the project that emerged in Brooklyn out of the Mental Health Criminal Justice Subcommittee. And I was just thinking, as we were talking about this before, we sort of nailed the diagnosis with that. The people were lost to care, but we flunked the prescription. What we found is that we could track them, but there was no integrated care and ongoing care. There was no health plan, in a sense. There's nobody responsible. So this is the data of high-risk people. This is people that come out of Rikers, come out of a state hospital, but on an AOT order, but on an ACT team, and get lost to care. Half of them were totally lost to care. Nobody knew where they were. A quarter of them were institutionalized, and a quarter of them were currently disengaged, but there was a really credible plan to work with them to get them back in care. So a point of service approach does not serve us very well. Then we have these other challenges that are adaptations to regular healthcare strategies for people with these conditions. Somebody can be functioning at 100% competence one day and be doing very poorly in another month. And a month from that be back to competence. And we sort of usually behave as if you're incompetent all the time, or if you're competent all the time, as opposed to adjusting stuff and working with people when they fall. So we know we need health information informed care management. We know we need this boots on the ground, feet on the street, as Donna called it, approach to reach out to people. And we also understand there's a particularly salient role for peers here, that they have a kind of face credibility with people in recovery, where professionals are sometimes scary. Something else that's emerging in this regard is, so I'm doing a lot of work at the national level on suicide prevention, and it turns out to be people in our systems that are at the highest rate of suicide. It's not defined by demographics. It's not defined by the other things we usually talk about. It's not veterans. The risk for veterans is elevated 3 to 4 times. The risk of people within a year of diagnosis of serious mental illness is magnified 12 times. So we've got to do much better in this regard. This is just another evidence, that people have seen this before about preventable readmissions. So total New York State costs for preventable readmissions in 2007 is $800 million. About 15 to 18% of that was people without a mental health or substance use disorder. 85% was people with a mental health and substance use disorder. Most of that was not behavioral readmissions, although that was pretty significant, but most of it was medical readmissions for people with these problems, speaking to the need for integration without losing the losing the essence of this. Here, this is a slide from the Framingham study, but I put it in here, not that it's applicable, but if you look over here on the right side, you see the lifestyle of people with serious mental illness. You couple this with indifferent medical care, and what you get is that, you know, average length of life that is achieved in sub-Saharan Africa. You know, people have looked at this. People with serious mental illness have reduced utilization of medical services. They don't get preventive services. They don't get good diabetes care. They have a low rate of high-intensity procedures, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We've got to integrate that. So we're also finding now that there is an evidence base for what's got to be done, not just these high-level summaries. Treatment that facilitates self-management is really important, not just symptom management. It's got to be integrated. This capacity of going out to get people who won't come in until they come in, and then they ought not to be on this kind of care anymore, of titrating this kind of care management so people get it when they need it and they don't when they don't. Integration. All right, last two slides sort of focus on the opportunity that we have, and this is not very well laid out yet, but we have a significant transformational opportunity to change our approach to first episode care as we start to manage some stuff in general, as we start to move toward integrated solutions, because, you know, sort of right now people fall many times before they figure out how to get a hand up, but we have pretty much a consensus now on what it takes to provide good first episode care. It's being done broad scale in Australia, in New Zealand, and it's starting to be used in the UK, and there have been demonstration projects in the United States, but it's not really branded yet. So we know from this evidence in other places and in the U.S. that basically getting with people right away when they have a psychotic break, and not just stabilizing them and giving them a referral, but sticking with them when they have a first break produces dramatically different outcomes. You get better response to medication with less medication. You sort of help them figure out what their education and career is instead of letting them lose that and then, you know, creating something suboptimal. And you really help them understand how to self-manage at a point in time when they're being very challenged by confusing symptoms and so on. Despite all this, the norm for entry into care after you've got psychotic symptoms in the United States is 2 years. So figuring out what we could do to get with people early and stay with them. And this is just some of the summary of what it takes, putting together a team that focuses specifically, in a sense, this is a different transition population. So we talk about, you know, people transitioning out of the youth system. This is also a transition. You're transitioning from being healthy to, you know, flunking out of college and the unusual approach of letting you become, you know, chronically disabled, and then you can come to day programs is not such a good idea. So this is just a very quick run through of where we ought to be going and what we ought to be working toward in our effort here.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of it aligns very closely with a lot of the goals that people
state,
right?
Yes, this is really good. So we're, you know, if we can synthesize it right, well, we'd be good. We are, yes. Question, comment a little bit? Yeah, this is supposedly posted now. So, yeah. The MRT website. I think we probably ought to give people paper copies.
Mike, one quick thing that really struck me seeing this, and I didn't want to mention primary care earlier because a lot of the folks are currently in a managed care plan. But looking at this, pay attention to people who are already in managed care, have a primary care provider, are not seriously mentally ill now, for kids and families. So we've seen that unless you really are able to identify your mental illness better with people who are not ill now, and particularly for their parents, who we see in our programs, you know, the high correlation between parents who are ill and the kids who are ill, they're going to end up, you know, our problems.
I would say there are actually two significant opportunities there. So I really, and one of those opportunities is to do a better job with detection of these disorders in the mainstream plans and in primary care. We sort of have a consensus about that, although we haven't figured out sort of how to advance that. We've had lots of conversations about that with people in the health department. We just haven't taken the steps yet to make that, you know, necessary. But the second point, Wendy, is that primary care, not just primary care, but primary care is going to be one of the main entry points for this much more intensive intervention. It's going to be where we catch people who have early psychotic symptoms. They come in to see the doctor. The parents don't know what's going on. That problem can't be resolved there. But we shouldn't, like, wait until they have a break. Or if they do have a break, we've got to immediately engage them in a specialized form of intervention. I see no reason why we can't do this now. We can't make this, you know, this have a requirement be, you know, plans are going to develop some pathway for first episode care.
I mean, another way of saying that is, you know, screening, brief intervention, or referral to treatment. I mean, it's, you know, the thing that takeaway was mentioned earlier when Rob was doing his slides about the 1.8 million or whatever. One of the really important points is that most of these folks that are listed as having received addiction services and who are sort of cycling through the system, that 85% you're talking about, are not people that are fully engaged in treatment in any way. They go into a hospital for a detox, they go back on the street, they go into the ER to treat for a psychiatric disorder, put back in the street. The 2 years you're talking about is it a failure on the part of primary care to be bridging with the mental health system?
Mike, on one of your slides where you talk about what was assured, it seems to me like there's one piece that would be interesting to think about, and I don't know if it's something we could hold people to, but this issue of a family resource or some kind of a social connection, it kind of gets to the peer issue and the recovery issue, but if people really don't have any attachment in the community, it's going to make it much harder for them to recover and stay well.
Yeah, and so we've just had, we haven't said anything specific about that, although it is somewhat reflected on our papers, although it may not rise to the level of significance, but just that there are two research studies just out within the last month that demonstrate, you know, pieces of this. One Harvey mentioned before, and it was actually a study that was launched before I left Ohio, and Judith Cook has just reported on it, but they actually did a trial of the efficacy of RAP, a wellness recovery action plan. So this is like sort of a personal life plan for living your life with one of these conditions. And, you know, so it turns out that's effective. But the other that was just reported was a study of NAMI's family-to-family program, which is a pretty low-key, a dozen sessions, sort of learning about the illness, learning how to work with your family member, learning about the system, and sort of learning how to be an advocate, and that also, you know, that tests out as being effective. So it's a little different point than what you're getting to, but these are critical, you know, it's ancillary, but not really ancillary aspects of this.
I just want to say, I have all the committee members' email address, so we all, beginning next week, we'll send you my two presentations. And if I can get yours electronically,
Is there anything, is there anything on the fourth disorder schizophrenia side like a Th2-9 suppression?
No.
Okay. So you have to wait for the...
Well, there are two things. You know, a psychotic disorder is going to be diagnosed absolutely reliably in the hand of any competent clinician. And it turns out that a competent clinician can do the same thing with depression. Depression is diagnosed as reliably as hip fracture. You have a qualified person doing it. But we haven't got it, you know, sort of reduced yet to a screen. And that goes to one of the challenges in these psychotic disorders, and it's a interesting and a complex challenge, which is there's one theory that says if we could get people who are on a course to a psychotic break before the psychotic break, could we ward it off? And there's some evidence that you can, but then that gets into a question of, you know, do you want to start giving people neuroleptics? And the downside of that is so great, you know. So I mean, you guys are the professionals, so tell me.
Thank you.
No, I mean, I think that is the challenge, right, for the neuroleptics. But I would just go back to depression. I think the other piece here is that you talked about it from the perspective of undiagnosed mental illness and undiagnosed depression, and that we need to increase screening. But one of the challenges, going back to the slide deck, is that you talked about how you can referrals may be challenging to actually accomplish. People don't go for referrals. Co-located services are really ideal. But that's often not the case, especially in managed care, where a number of providers are solo providers or group providers of primary care, but not necessarily having co-located mental health services.
Right.
But the other piece that I think is important to try and promote is the notion of primary care providers treating and feeling comfortable treating depression.
Right.
And getting, and that goes back to the, well, diagnosing it and then initiating treatment, maybe having a co-management model if they're having issues, and because the capacity may not be there on the mental health provider side.
Right. So this, let me go just a little deeper into this with respect to the, where what the consensus is that I think we're close to achieving, but when we haven't really articulated it yet. And that is that when we talk about, I guess the consensus that's emerging for me is to say that the standard of care in primary care. And what I'm going to say here is, in anything that's a group practice or bigger, you know, so not a solo practitioner, but if it's a health center, you know, or if it's a significant primary care practice, then the standard of care is essentially what's come to be called collaborative care. And collaborative care is a package. And collaborative care says you screen, you have somebody competent to deal with the issue on the floor. It might just be a nurse who's cross-trained in depression enough to be able to, you don't have to be a clinical, that's a clinical psychologist, but you've got to have somebody who's minimally competent in the condition, and that person has got to be on the floor, available to provide the initial intervention, to do some patient education, to do some care management, to check in, are you taking your meds, are the side effects okay, and then this notion of stepped care. So I think our consensus is, to do collaborative care in to require it and to begin to pay for it in organized care settings. Solo practice, I don't have an answer for that. But it's also true that, you know, a lot of solo practitioners are comfortable, you know, testing this and managing a fair amount of it themselves if they can have backup for more complicated cases. And
I'm going to bring that up. I think that Bobby said it fine. I think there often needs to be some ability for the primary care doctor to also consult with the psychiatrist.
Yes.
You have to build that in too, otherwise their comfort level with doing this goes down very quickly. So if you have that available, plus someone on site like a nurse or social, or anyone who can pick it up, you can do a lot of treatment of depression and also basic anxiety disorders
right. In
primary care practice with the primary care doctor. And that greatly reaches out of your arm for being able to have access.
So I think we should move. They keep having questions and comments.
So there is one other piece, which is that the prevalence of depression in maternal depression suggests that a particular focus on pediatricians.
This is another challenge. So that the I'll get the kids in a second and talk about that, but the. There does have to be a challenge is that a lot of moms, the only doctor they're going to see is their pediatrician. And so, you know, how do we work around that one? You know, so, yeah, big challenge. So let's go to, all right, you get the very last word, Donna.
It's first grade, so it's not good. Anyway, you mentioned the issue of alternatives to first grade. I know a couple of models, another model in Australia, and you mentioned incentivizing requiring managed care and
Here's the way that I would approach this, which I would describe as conservative but aggressive. You know? And that is to say that we ought to have an expectation that there's a care pathway for first episode psychosis. The expectation is that we will catch it and we will get people into an appropriate approach to care. Now, that doesn't
have to necessarily get creative beyond the boundaries of the current benefit. Because if we just would, you know, sort of stay with people, give them the minimal necessary dosage of whatever it is, and educate them, which is basically it's an adaptive form of psychotherapy about what they're going to have to do to live with the illness. That's all covered now. We just don't do it. Now, getting into the alternatives is a little more, you know, creative, and we could talk about that too. But that, you know, it's a little bit more. So, anyway, that's just my take on it. So let's move. So Andy and Adam talk about, this is a primer on integrating care. Oh, I thought we were gonna do this next.
Like the kids.
All right. Sorry, Adam. Sit down. Your boss says me. So this is a briefer. As I said, kids are smaller. So it's smaller, but it's more complicated. So this is the same thing. This is trying to integrate science and the sort of like what I would describe as the highest state of the well-established knowledge. Now, there might be some disagreement about certain pieces of this, but that's just my take on it. So this is the scope of the problem. Focused here just on what we call serious emotional disturbance. And serious emotional disturbance is essentially diagnosis plus disability. It's not just diagnosis. So diagnosis and impairment would be a better term for kids. So the numbers are large, way larger than these more in vogue conditions. One of the real challenges we face in talking about this is a very high proportion of kids with severe emotional disturbance who get care in the New York State system are not Medicaid eligible. So these are kids of, you know, working class families who get these complicated disorders, and what they need is not covered by insurance. Now, over time, we hope that will change a little bit. But if you require wraparound care or intensive therapeutic case management, that's the term I'm making up, you're not going to get that from most commercial plans. And this is one of the, this, you know, goes to Gail's point about pediatrics in part, but that is, these numbers are actually a little greater in New York. These are national numbers, and we have a higher profile specialty system here, but only a small minority of kids with emotional disturbance. But this is not a mental illness. This is with mental illness plus impairment get specialty mental health care. Ever see any mental health professional? And only a fraction of this would be Medicaid. This is to include private therapists and so on as well. And then mental health visits are the largest single category of visits to pediatrics, except during flu season. But pediatricians, you know, sort of aren't adequately paid for this, aren't adequately staffed for this, and consistently report that referrals to mental health are much more frustrating than referrals to any other, you know, specialty health sector. And then the consequences are pretty obvious. A majority of kids, you know, anywhere between two-thirds and 85% of kids in juvenile justice settings have these conditions. By best estimates, 40% plus of kids in the foster care system, which is scarcely surprising given that you're in the foster care system largely because of, you know, something that was traumatic. And we don't do very well with these kids. So that's just the need. Okay, now bear with me on this. This is a pathway for how these conditions develop that leads into what's indicated in terms of solutions. So if we start with early childhood, what we see is that most early childhood behavioral disturbance is environmentally mediated. So, which stands to order then that the solutions ought to be sort of environmentally relevant. But then, this is not absolutely true, because you have kids that develop these biologically loaded conditions at a very young age. But generally speaking, the risk of the biologically loaded conditions like ADHD, depression, bipolar disorder, escalate as you get into adolescence. And then these problems tend to compound when they're unaddressed. And then, you know, the compounding with interest and the absence of good intervention leads to, you know, all these problems that we're aware of. So if this is sort of how things emerge, it suggests three broad intervention strategies. The first of these, we haven't talked about that much, although it's come up a little bit, and that is that targeted prevention, and I emphasize targeted prevention here because the generalized prevention is probably unaffordable or unthinkable in this, you know, in this culture. So the targeted prevention, the evidence is sort of in now. So a good example of that would be treating the mom's depression. As I already said, treating the mom's depression is very effective in resolving the kid's problems. And there are all kinds now of intensive parenting supports that have developed and tested around the world. There's one right developed right here in New York, Parent Corps, developed by Lori Miller-Brotman at NYU that has now been tested for over a dozen years. And basically giving very at-risk parents very concrete supports in things like appropriate discipline and setting limits and praising and recognizing good behavior and so on are associated with, you know, sort of measurable improvements for the kids without doing anything with the kids directly.
Name?
Lori Miller-Brotman. So this is interesting for us because prevention per se is outside the scope of our work, probably, kind of. On the one hand, under the Accountable Care Act, and this goes in a sense to a point that Paul made earlier, preventive services are supposed to be included in plans incrementally over time with pretty concrete obligations by 2014. So the question of the extent to which there's, you know, focused investments maybe supported by New York State and stuff that we know is relevant. So anyway, that's the first set of interventions. The second set of interventions are as these conditions start to develop, but before they've got, you know, by the time you get over on the far right-hand side here, this stuff is really complicated and multi-axial and involves, you know, multiple systems of care and so on. But as these things start to develop, ADHD, for example, as it starts to develop, targeted therapies are very effective. And they generally involve, you know, what are called combined treatments. So we know that the stimulus medication for the ADHD reduces the hyperactiveness as long as the kid is on it, but it doesn't do anything to help them manage it. So if you combine the appropriate medication with the right coaching for the parent and the kid, then you get a different outcome. You know, same thing is true for depression. So your responses to adolescent depression with medication alone, if you have the right medication, are in the range of, you know, 60 to 70%. Same thing if you have the right psychotherapy alone. If you have the right psychotherapy and the right medication, you get responsiveness in the 75 to 80% range. So targeted therapies. And then finally, when we get to the kids with more complicated issues, it becomes a little bit like the adult evidence-based practice, although they have to be kid-specific and age-appropriate, and that is these are team treatments. So an interdisciplinary team that is very family-centric that focuses on the problem. A couple of examples here. So then, this is actually a picture of a real kid in California. It's not, you know, and anyway, enough said. All right, well, the transitions here are screwed up. So the this is just a different way to summarize what I said. We need to do more targeted and focused prevention. Now, there's a much more robust approach to prevention in the addiction treatment system. There's the mental health system where we do almost none of it, but the evidence is now in that we need to be doing more. Late intervention is the norm. The average age of onset, if you're going to experience a mental disorder in your lifetime, is 14. The average age of onset is 14. The average delay between symptoms and entering care is 9 years. So the focus, in this case,
If we're going to do more good, the focus has to be pediatrics. And we've got a wonderful small collaborations going with pediatrics that involve training and assistance with referrals and so on, and telephonic consultation. So they're just, we have to help re-engineer pediatrics additionally. And then the last point here is the sort of where we've been focused more. The kids that have complex and well-developed problems, you have to have a combination of specialty management. I know of no instance where anything other than specialty management has worked. And then that specialty management has also got to have these evidence-based practices embedded in it. These just a couple. So this, as I get into the bottom of this here, this begins to get into Mike's opinion as opposed to science has established it because nobody's studied it yet. Well, there are people here that have done a bunch of it, Phil, right?
We're working on it.
Okay, so that's just the kids' summary. So, like, you know, 2 minutes for questions, comments, conversations about that.
I just have a quick comment, especially when you're dealing with kids. If you don't deal with the family, you're really, you know, compromising outcomes.
Absolutely. I would say that the jury is in on that one. That should have been added as a, you know, as evidence.
You know, the evidence is very clear that if the cycle's not broken, it's going to break the bank. So I don't know what could be clearer than this presentation about the need to take action and use this opportunity to try to do something better and different.
I think one of the challenges on that is I wonder how much excess Medicaid expenditure is a result of kids not well treated. And I'm betting that it's much delayed. It happens at later stage of their life, and so it's going to be harder to demonstrate where the savings are from investments in kids, unless we can make the case that 10 years out, when they're adults,
yeah, but you know what? But not really, because the trauma is evident in the behavior that happens much earlier, and you see that everywhere. So you're going to see that in juvenile justice, and you're going to see that in foster care. You're just going to see it.
So you know, one way to pick up on that. I mean, a lot of people are familiar with now the so-called Adverse Childhood Experiences, or ACE study, and there was just this nice little thing in the New Yorker about a month ago called the Poverty Clinic, about a solo practice doc in the inner city who figured out that she was delivering excellent medical care, totally missing the point on her kids' problems. And then it goes off to this study which tracked early life traumatic experiences for adults. And so to these guys, who did this study, which involved the CDC as well as Vince Spalletti, this internal medicine guy at Kaiser, here's their statement. A majority of adult chronic illness is attributable to childhood traumatic experiences.
It has a geometric and compounded effect as the person ages.
So they've shown this correlationally. They haven't shown this causally, and it sounds like a little bit much. But then you sort of think about, you know, childhood sexual abuse leading to maladaptive behavior and poor social functioning. You say premature sex, you start smoking early, you drop out of school, you're probably drinking too much, you don't take care of your weight. And, you know, should anybody be surprised that you develop, you know, diabetes, COPD by the time you're in your 40s? But that's their statement. It's not my statement. But it certainly does suggest that, you know, trying to figure out how to do more early is something we have to think about.
As we do whatever our final product is, it would seem to me that this, and I think it's obviously we did a special presentation on kids. We've had a lot of conversations here. You know, just going back to the governor's State of the State address, the one moment I think when he was most passionate when he was indicting the juvenile justice system, which the current commissioner at OCFS calls racist and inefficient, it would seem to me that we have an amazing opportunity to really do something here in terms of making recommendations. I think, you know, your use of the word, you know, prevention, particularly as we're talking about more integration, if we have a robust system of prevention professionals in the substance use disorder area, you know, how can those resources be brought to bear? How can we sort of do something with this system that'll take us a better place? And frankly, you know, we can look at outcomes and we can look at the budget numbers as well and say, you know, we could make much better use of resources, and work collaboratively with the health department. It would be a real shame if we missed this opportunity.
I talked too much. I was just going to say, you know, that the educational expenses in Medicaid alone would be reason enough to try to do something else, too. I mean, it's just extraordinary amounts of money.
Okay, good.
Andy at the board. Andy Cohen is the mayor's director of health policy working at City Hall. He's been with me and my team and doing a fabulous job. And Dr. Adam Carpati is the deputy commissioner of the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, supervising the mental health services division.
Okay, so Adam and I are going to tag team a little bit, but we're just going to talk a little bit about integration of primary care and behavioral health care for people with serious mental illness and substance abuse disorders. And much of this is stuff that we've talked about today, so it'll all common concepts and themes. We're just briefly going to talk about the high mortality and disease burden among people with SMI and substance abuse disorders, the prevalence of chronic disease and other physical health issues, and then Adam's going to talk about some structural strategies for integrating care at the practice level, and I'm going to talk about the softer, probably less sciencey structural strategies for integrating care at the system level, just talking about what's been kind of evaluated so far. Can you hear me? Better? Okay.
Okay. You use the data about doing this where? What's the context? In New York City or the government? What are we talking about?
So really, we're talking about both the need for or the consequences of fragmented care, perhaps, as well as talking about some strategies that have been used elsewhere and sort of like core elements of them in designing a system for integration.
Just to bring in this notion of the physical health needs and the burden of non-behavioral health conditions in behavioral health populations, many references today have been made to this particular analysis, which was a very nice study of matching records of individuals being served by public mental health systems in multiple states across the country to vital registry data in order to calculate mortality rates. And it was across these various states that this sort of iconic and very provocative number of 25 years, potential years of life lost on average across all these different states came in. The additional point, other than the most dramatic finding of lower high mortality rates, lower life expectancy, is that though rates of mortality due to behavioral health related causes like suicide or overdose or things like that are higher in these populations, maybe in the order of 35 to 40% of the mortality attributable to those factors, the majority of mortality, excess mortality, continues to be due to things that are the leading causes of death in the general population as well, namely cardiovascular disease, diabetes, COPD, infectious diseases. So that's really not only the disparity, but the underlying causes of that disparity are really visible. This is data from New York City, just to give a little local context, from our own survey of health across the city. In this analysis, we're looking at people who report high levels of so-called psychological distress. This is the scale of a six-item scale developed by Kessler that is often used as a proxy for more serious mental illness. When it's accompanied by disability. And just, it's sort of self-evident here that, compared to the general population, those with poor mental health, nearly half reporting self-reported general health status as fair or poor compared to only 18% of the general population. And self-reported health status is a pretty good, actually, marker for everything else, whether that's cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, et cetera. So that's a pretty dramatic disparity there. Smoking rates are very high. Of course, if this data were further drilled down into the, schizophrenia or more serious mentally ill population, you'd see the smoking rates even higher. obesity rates, hypertension, diabetes. I'm really just illustrating the burden of physical health conditions in this population. And as we've discussed many times, we asked this question about people, you know, was there a time in the last 12 months where you needed medical care but did not get it? And again, those who were responding high on the psychological distress scale, high for this marker of mental illness, had nearly a 3 times higher rate of saying they weren't able to access care despite needing it. So very provocative results there. This is Medicaid data in New York State from a United Hospital Fund report that illustrates some of the same principles here. Those are particular physical health and some behavioral health conditions stratified by those with a primary mental illness, in this case, higher rates of hypertension, heart disease, asthma, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, not only for those with a primary mental illness, but primary substance use disorder, also a very high rate of some of these conditions as well. We've seen various data on this very topic here as well, just noting that this is also from the UHF report, you know, that the higher spending, both for those with a primary mental health and a primary substance use disorder, in this case, it's, I just pulled out the inpatient care numbers, and most of the spending is actually not on related to the primary diagnosis. So in terms of sort of responding to these, this well-described, very common, and this disparity in physical health status, you know, I think what we're talking about a lot today is sort of what are the strategies for integrating physical health care, medical care into the behavioral health and behavioral health population. At the city, we've tried to, you know, we have good relationships with our primary care colleagues around the city. And, you know, in addition to talking to them about, you know, diabetes and blood pressure control and smoking and HIV, we've been trying to engage that community in talking about behavioral health and talking specifically about the role of the primary care system in collaborating with the specialty behavioral health system to do good physical health care. We have a couple of reports. These are essentially clinical guidelines for the primary care community on improving the health of adults with serious mental illness and those improving the health of those who use drugs. So in these, we talk about what is it that primary care providers should be doing when they collaborate with behavioral health professionals. Clearly, you know, there is a primary responsibility around caring for illnesses that contribute to increased morbidity and mortality, those non-behavioral health-related illnesses. There is a variety, you know, doing good primary care, of course, is, you know, something that should be done for everybody. There's particular modifiable risk factors that are often addressed in primary care settings that need special attention in these populations, whether it's substance use, medication adherence, tobacco, of course, is a huge issue, nutrition as well. So really highlighting the role of the primary care physician, primary care practitioner, as a component of this care team. So in, you know, the summary, the way we sort of synthesize this for primary care practitioners, they should be coordinating care with specialty care health providers. They should be doing their, you know, the same kind of preventive care that everyone else gets, but in addition, being alert to specific conditions that may have a higher prevalence in behavioral health populations, whether that's you know, liver and neurologic disease from alcohol or infectious diseases related to drug use. They need to be partners in managing and monitoring, for example, mental health and symptomatology. We've talked a lot about depression screening and things like that. But this, in the case of people being served primarily in the behavioral health system, there continues to be a role for the primary care physician in managing the mental illness and the mental health of those patients. Of clearly managing the physical health, the physical issues related to medication side effects, especially, for example, in the case of the second generation antipsychotics, which have very profound impact on metabolic indicators. And then, of course, all the lifestyle choices that primary care is in the habit of dealing with need to be particularly addressed in these populations. And then, conversely, specialty providers working with PCPs need to be coordinating care, managing how the conversation and risks and benefits around treatment, especially around medication treatment, works. collaboratively around managing medications, being involved in the comorbid and managing comorbid health conditions and addressing modifiable behaviors. So there's a variety of different models for how this sort of primary care, specialty care collaboration works. This is a popular schema that really tries to, you know, sort of explain and help guide this question of sort of where is the locus of accountability on the primary care side and the specialty side and the collaboration, where is the appropriate venues for delivering care. On the y-axis here is the level of behavioral health risk. On the x-axis is the level of physical health status and physical health risk. And, you know, patients with different profiles of behavioral and physical health needs may need different service mixes, different locus of care. I think those are some of the issues that we've been, that many of us have raised here today.
So the next, in the next few slides, we're going to talk a little bit about what we've been talking about all day today, and I guess my my thinking would be that at the end of this process, we'll write our own slides and, you know, fill in the content here to replace what's here. But this basically is kind of an adaptation of some sort of core concepts that others working with Medicaid programs around the country have kind of developed in trying to, and there really is, you know, we've been told by many, there is no sort of gold standard fully integrated Medicaid system around the country, although many different experiments are going on around the country to move in that direction, to move away from fee-for-service behavioral health care and move towards managed care and done in a variety of different ways. So again, we'll ultimately as a group probably replace, tweak, or modify these, but sort of as some preliminary ideas, some key elements of system integration. So Adam was really talking about what happens at the clinical level. In practice for treatment, this is about sort of core components of a system. You need, obviously, a care coordination function. We've talked a lot about that today, but that has to be at the, you know, the system has to provide for that, has to pay for that, et cetera. You need health information exchange. Luckily, here in New York State, we have a sort of strong foundation for that to be electronic and interoperable, but there's other ways to do it, of course, as well. You need aligned incentives. That really goes to sort of the payment conversation and organizational conversation that we had today, but you need to have all different parts of an integrated system moving towards the same outcomes and incentivized to move towards the same outcomes, and you need consumer engagement in the design and sort of and development of the system as well, of course, needing consumer engagement in the actual care. Just a little more depth on each one of these. We all know, we've talked, and I think enough today, we all know what care coordination is. You need a navigator, an informed navigator for individuals with care needs across systems. Ideally, again, this is just a proposed concept, but it seems like we had a lot of agreement about this today, that care coordination function should be really based in what is the primary kind of health home for that person, whether that's a behavioral health provider or a physical health provider. It needs to be really clearly designated and can be a mechanism to connect people to social supports. Health information exchange has to be more than something just kind of theoretical that someone in the system has access to the information, but has to be designed so that the appropriate data is available, like at the clinical level and timely, preferably electronic. And it does raise really thorny issues, especially in discussing behavioral healthcare issues, about whether our current regulations and laws and other things really are exactly appropriate to facilitating this kind of exchange and making sure there are appropriate safeguards and security in place, while at the same time not interfering with providers having the information that they need to treat patients with their consent, of course. On aligned incentives, again, we've talked about it quite a bit today. You need it at the payer level and at the provider level. You need mechanisms for rewarding quality care. You need mechanisms for sharing savings that might come from reducing avoidable hospitalizations or emergency visits, and we suggest in reinvestment into behavioral health care delivery systems to share savings. And you need joint and standardized performance measures so that you don't have one side of the house, you know, working towards one set of outcomes and goals and another side of the house working towards a different set of outcomes and goals, and none of them are shared or standardized. And lastly, of course, consumer engagement is important, obviously, for the design of the system, that the system is for the patients, and they need to be there needs to be involvement in the design, but it also, any kind of, like, reform needs to leverage good, strong, established provider relationships and not do away with them. And that's it. Tried to be fast.
So, I guess in my mind, I'm just when the commissioner will be talking about
To be clear, when I say that we're not trying to lay out a design of a system that we're proposing, I think what we're trying to say is, based on a review of literature and talk to experts and people who've tried to develop integrated systems in different areas of the country, these are some principles that have sort of emerged from that say, a well-functioning integrated system has these components, but we're not, virtually everything in here is sort of also resonates with the ideas that, as a group, we came up with today. This was just sort of trying to lay a base for thinking about what the components of a system might be, but it's not to say this isn't really a design.
I mean, I think the nice thing about it is that really what went up here, I think, was reflected a lot in the goals. So it looks like some of those elements when sort of searching the world, and there aren't that many examples, quite frankly, but searching for where people have really already tried to do this kind of integration, what are the components of what they've done that were important, or that's reflected in their literature or their program description. And the elements that came out here, I think, were very common to the goal setting that was done earlier.
And I guess part of it is, those components could exist in a variety of different designs. See what I'm saying?
I understand that there's so many imperfections. We talk about ACS. We talk about the merger of ACS and criminal justice. If you look at homeless services, obviously, where you have a population that has mental health problems, substance use problems, and primary care needs, so I thought that maybe what we were talking about is figuring out a way to have an integrated city-state one.
July 12th.
Let me take a little bit of a crack at this. And the way this is a finesse, but in a way, I think it does go to that issue, and that is that, again, our core responsibility is to think through what this stage two of care management, or really, you know, what it's going to look like when we get into this integrated delivery system, BHO, special needs plan arrangement. Having said that, we're not limited to that. We've talked about a range of other issues, recommendations for integration in primary care, and so on. But an important bridge to what you're saying is that we've really kind of made a decision through the MRT, but it's reinforced by regionalism, and it's reinforced by, you know, how this plan stuff works, that these specialty plans that we'll be developing will be developed on a regional basis. You know, so that's thought number one. And thought number two is that New York City is a region. So without actually going to what all those connections are that would have to be worked out in city government and with the state, we sort of have got pre-designed a framework that says
one of our focal points will be to think about this across the, you know, across the city and across Long Island and across
the state.
It's interesting, though, how it came out. I mean, I think, you know, Linda, this process has worked, although everybody's going to want to see, you know, how it comes back to us. But a lot of stuff has resonated here. And this point that came from several people about the different uniquenesses that exist in different parts of the state and wanting to preserve that while at the same time we rationalize the system, that came through pretty strongly. But I just was thinking, I didn't mean to, you know, sort of grab the mic here, but we're still sticking with what Andy and Adam have laid out.
I want to relate this to the no wrong door, I think, comment that was made earlier, and the quadrants, I suppose, because there's also quadrants, by the way, like this, with people with substance use and behavioral health issues. Who's a better provider to really treat this person, primarily substance use, with secondary illness? So I think these quadrants sort of give us some framework as to who really should be the provider, so to speak, in care coordination. Rupert, but the issue of no wrong door, particularly for people who are individuals who need a great deal of engagement to bring into the system. And so the idea that a behavioral health provider, in a clinic sense, could provide some primary care, which we right now can under the current regime, or do some co-location, you know, with a health provider. Because, frankly, when we are, particularly with the high need, high use of ER and hospitalizations that are not currently engaged in any system, once we can get them in, which takes some time, they're certainly not going to first step in to make the appointment with the health provider someplace over there. In fact, it's so integrated in terms of their mental health issues and their health issues that without getting the substance use and mental health issues dealt with and addressed, it's very hard to start really working on the RAP plan and wellness plans around wellness, health wellness. So you kind of really have to make sure that gets integrated. And that no-wrong door quadrant in terms of where the person first engages, can we create a system that allows for that integration at that level? With the intention that at some point people mainstream into general health, hopefully, and general mental health.
You're right that those axes are somewhat just a heuristic. You can imagine even like another one coming out around the social media. Sort of how to think about integrating, whether you might have high, but, you know, so that's another consideration in terms of sort of where the hub and where the central delivery of care and coordination of that sits.
I'm just wondering whether today, or perhaps in your presentation, but also today, have we decided, or
well, I think that gets back to some of our venue discussions and options this morning, is when is a co-location model effective? I think a number of providers that at the front line managed to get themselves licensed under multiple systems in a single location so that you have that kind of physical proximity. I don't know that it's, I think probably figuring out how much you want that, if you think it's the right model, the next question is can you really do it affordably across the entire system? And when do you have to default to a more virtual, you know, collaboration?
So I don't think we've really decided anything yet,
yeah.
But we've you know, sort of framed a broad direction in a sense of things to work on. But there are several things that we've discussed that are, I think, you know, sort of what I would describe as propositions, group propositions that have to be yet tested and so on. And sort of one of those propositions is that more of this integration at the level of the, you know, of the provider is a good thing. But, like, too much of it is probably not a good thing. But, you know, so what does that mean? So to how do we work that? So we've sort of said, I came up with this recommendation before that said that collaborative care ought to be adopted as the standard model in any group ambulatory medical practice. I think that's defensible, but we don't have consensus on that yet. And, you know, and the same thing that, you know, sort of what ought to be the, how much of this how much of the medical care should be taken on in primary addiction treatment or mental health settings? Well, more. I think the answer is pretty clear. More, pretty clearly more. But how much of it? You know, I don't think we know the answer to for that. So, are we ready to sort of migrate to what happens next?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
We actually haven't rehearsed this.
So, we're sort of, we wanted to get through this meeting, which I think we're close to having accomplished pretty well. So, let me just take a couple of whacks at stuff, Linda, and then you can sort of fill in and correct, or and we have to sort of make some group decisions. What I think I know is true is that we meet next on July 12th at 1 p.m. at the offices of OASAS in Albany. And then we meet following, we have one additional following meeting that's scheduled on August 1 at 10 o'clock somewhere in the city, this city. But we don't know where yet. So that's established. Second, we've said that we'll have by the next meeting the staff synthesis of the work we did this morning, which implies to me that one of the things we'll want to do at the next meeting is to spend some time discussing that. And maybe we'll even by the end of that meeting, have a consensus and agreement on it. I think we should have agreement on that.
With the feedback loop before that meeting, so the feedback, the comment, hopefully it won't take the whole meeting, that it'll look familiar and right.
And something else that we sort of talked about before and sort of said kind of sort of yes, but I want to test this concretely, is that I would recommend that at the next meeting, that is on July 12th, that we have some kind of an overview of what the state's thinking is with respect to health homes and some conversation about that. So, Greg, do you lead that? And then I think to inform that, it would be really helpful if everybody could look at those three sets of things that Greg described that were posted on the, or about to be posted with the health department. He just had to take the calls. Anybody else? Is that stuff on the MRT page, or does anybody know? There's a health home page, okay. Yeah. So, okay, so, and we will in a subsequent communication clarify where to find that stuff, but it would be really good if we could come to that conversation prepped with some review. And we're probably not going to do, we're probably not going to do line by line here, but we want to have a significant conversation about the substantive issues that that arise. So that's about as far as I can go in terms of what I think is clear. This is a very dangerous part of the meeting because we're at that stage in the group process where there are a lot of things we could sort of like to do, and the panic of our completing the task has not, set in yet. So I don't want to get too expansive about this. And so let me ask my coach here, what are your ideas about how to have a successful next meeting that will not be quite as long as this? We wanted to get off to a robust start.
Well, here, you see on the agenda, we had actually sort of brainstormed a little bit about what possible future meeting topics would be. If we wanted to use those meeting times to actually work through important areas, what are the things where we need to sort of collectively process our thinking in order to develop recommendations? So, at the end of the day, we want a set of recommendations, obviously a consensus set of recommendations to send on to the full review, Medicaid review, task force, the reform, or whatever MRT stands for. Redesign, Medicaid redesign task force. And I do think another to do is to get some budget folks assigned to us. Okay, I really do think that we need, I don't think we want to have recommendations at the end and then start a process. I think we actually would like some feedback from budget folks along the way and helping us to fund out the savings and think about the price tag associated with the reinvestment. It feels like that work is probably important as well. Otherwise, we were just essentially fully discussions of each of the brief discussions we had today.
Right. So, and I remember one other thing which was, we
did sort of task Eileen and Richard maybe to sort of give us a brain dump about what the state of the art looks like from your point of view. To give us a specialty managed care point of view about this stuff.
Maybe those are the great topics for the next meeting, to hear about the broader vision on health homes, which we have to be aligned with, right? And then to get some models, because I think the reimbursement models say a lot about the principles of the system underneath. And so maybe to get some of that, those models, and then move on to some of the other, that feels cool, like it was probably the firmer framework, and then move on to sort of the details within that.
It's just a thought. I think, like, at some point, you know, go back to the very first exercise we did, and we, you know, the first comment and the last comment being, you know, no harm, and then actually it's got to be about a lot more than that. It seems to me that if we were to take everything we did and somehow add to it and have some more great discussions, put things together, there's going to be sort of a question of like, well, how's this going to work? What's it going to look like? And those are the questions that people get really, you know, uptight about. And but my thought is that we should probably have some conversation somewhere along the process. It talks a little bit about, not minute mechanics, but just like, well, how do we envision this actually getting done? Let's talk about some of the potential. What are the safeguards we can build in to make sure that no harm is done, to make sure that we have better outcomes? If we came up with our little list of key principles or whatever it is, here's what we think has to be a part of this package. When the legislature gives everybody, here's what we think has to be a part of it in order for it to be really what we're envisioning. I think that would really help, and it would help to sort of satisfy, I think, some of the folks who are here representing.
Well, sort of one way to work with that is that we could, it seems to me, John, that's sort of the framework that we might apply to the four possible topics that are here. So in a sense, we had some stimulus presentations that were very general and, you know, sort of describing the high ground in a sense. And then the question is, how do we transition from where we are to that? I tend to agree with Linda that we're going to have a pretty full agenda with just the stuff we've already bitten off. But maybe we can start a conversation about one or more of these things, and think about some exercise to begin to address one of these issues if we have more time at the next meeting.
Wouldn't the presentation that Eileen would be taking charge of? Funding that we get from the state, which includes, which includes, you know, vocational training, employment, housing, includes variety. Well, for me, for Samaritan Village, I would say I treat veterans without Veterans Administration money. So at some point, we do have to take a look at all those other funding streams that are not really part of Medicaid, but complement what it is that we do and how those things do fit, recognizing the point that you don't want to pull something towards a program that could hurt you on the other side. But you know, housing is a big need, and we do a lot around housing with the little bit of money that you saw that's put in on the chart that are presented. I think that's the point that maybe at the third meeting we figure out how to deal with. But I do agree to start with structure, because it sounds like first you need a reimbursement structure, and you need to be able to calculate what expenses you have. You do have models that can say that you can have strategic alliances where you have a complement or a service delivery network, I think you called it. That could be one. You could have the health homes. I also like the idea of providers not necessarily taking on more than they can chew, but if you co-locate programs, mental health and substance abuse programs in one site, that could be another model. You can have like four or five models on how to do this. I think that's how you begin to structure out how it would work.
It was very well put and so well put. We should let it be the last word.
Yeah.
Don't have to flatter him.
Thank you.
Quick announcement. There is a mailbox set up on the website, so if any of the public has comments, they can send their comments. The mailbox will be monitored regularly, and we'll include that in the input.
With Google members, Bob?
Yeah, it's on the website. So
and will we see
MRT? Yes, on the, if you go to the MRT website, you could access it from there.
Thank you, everybody.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because you just look at it. That's the point of the question.
Yeah,
I'll
say, yeah, I wish I got it.